The regular supplemental meetings are called to order. I'd like to start with a moment of silence for those people that aren't with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we'll go to the minutes of the November meeting. Any questions or comments on those? If not, I have a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag?
Nothing unusual.
What is that number 9 item? It was something with revoking dropped contributions or?
Right. So in as part of the 2017 legislation, people that had previously entered drop could undo their entry into drop and pay back the contribution or and make the contributions that they owed, and their drop balance gets wiped out. But some people paid for their contributions right away, and other people didn't. And if they didn't pay right away, they have to pay with interest. They just need to pay for that before they retire. That's
okay.
What that is. Most people pay right
away. So it's money coming in, not going out.
Exactly.
Okay. We don't see that.
We do have a tunnel for that. We have a
the Roach Motel?
Yeah. No, we have to dust it off every once in a while, but we do have a path for money in. Okay, we have a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Move approval.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Public comment. Anyone here in person would like to speak, or is anyone on the phone would like to speak?
On the phone, they'll press 5-star. I'll unmute.
Okay. Any of y'all want to say anything? Okay. Thank you. All right. Now we're going to go to item C1. Joe and Matt from BDO. Have you kind of review things with us, and then we'll talk about the formal 2021 audit opinion.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you all for having us here this morning. We just went over a lot of this in great detail with the audit committee, so I will keep my comments high level, but if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me, and I'm happy to go over that. I'm going to go ahead and jump into the status of our audit. We have completed our audit, so we are ready to issue our opinion upon your approval and receipt of the management rep letter. So that is good to go. Just to remind the board, the objective of our audit is to obtain reasonable assurance, not absolute assurance. And so we believe our procedures do allow us to express an unmodified opinion on the financial statements. We also have read all the other information included in the financial statements to make sure that it is consistent with the financial statements, and that there were no issues with any of that information as well. I do want to acknowledge management and Brenda and her team. They were fantastic partners throughout this audit, providing us all the information that we need, and everything was freely available to us. The accounting policies, practices, estimates that are most significant to the financial statements are included in notes 2, 4, and 5 of the financial statements. The policies, practices, methods of estimation, those things were all consistently applied throughout the year and consistent with the prior year. So there were no changes from that perspective. The most significant estimates that go into your financial statements are the actuarial estimates along with the fair value measurements of your investments. Corrected and uncorrected misstatements. I'd like to point out that we were given a very clean set of books, so we did not have any adjustments that management had to make or were proposed by us and passed. So we had They did a great job with record keeping, so no issues with the book. Also no issues with the quality of financial reporting. Again, Brenda and team does a great job putting together the financial statements and ensuring they include everything that's required and are properly disclosing what they need to. So no problems with that. The next few slides go into detail on the procedures that we go through, so I won't read these all to you, but we do look at internal controls for purpose of planning our audit. We do not express an opinion on the controls, but we do have to take that into consideration. We looked at actuarial valuations, eligibility, benefit payments, investments, and so on throughout. In some of the general areas that we look at is fraud, commitments and contingencies, subsequent events, going concern, those types of things. Fraud, we do detailed journal entry testing. We do interview a select group of you, as well as members of management and other employees, to understand where it could be perpetrated. And then also on commitments and contingencies, we do look at legal expenses. We get legal confirmation letters and verify that any legal matters that need to be disclosed are appropriately disclosed in the financial statements. As it relates to going concern, the auditing standards require us to consider a period of 12 months after our issuance date. So from that perspective, there are no issues with the fund being able to continue 1 year past our audit date. As I mentioned, we do look at internal control. While we are not specifically opining on internal control, as we review them, if things come to our attention, we do work with management on that. I am happy to report there were no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies in internal controls. This next slide just goes through a few additional considerations and communications. Independence, we are independent of the system. One of the others I'd point out on here is specialized services or consultations. We use our internal valuation experts to help us with some of the valuation work on the investment, and we use experts in our actuarial team to review the actuarial report. So we do employ our own actuaries, and so they do help us do the detailed testing and work on your actuarial report. And there were no issues from that perspective. And that's pretty much it from our standpoint. If there are any questions specifically related to the audit, I am happy to take those on.
Just not a question, maybe a statement. Our process is fully transparent, correct? You find no issues of non-transparency of anything. Everything is open to the members and always has been, right?
I can speak to everything I've ever asked for was given to me freely. So there was nothing ever held back as far as the audit goes. So I can speak to my specific experience on that. Management was very straightforward, forthcoming, provided all the information we requested, and they're actually very proactive during the year. If something comes up, they will call us and we'll talk through it so that we're already aware of something ahead of the audit. But yeah, we've never had any issues with getting the information we need to be able to do the audit.
Just for clarification, what year did you become contracted with DPFP to perform these services?
The first year we audited was 2014. So that's the first year we audited, it was 2014.
And the big item every year is the HUP valuation, and it's volatile. What did you find this year? I mean, is it just consistent application of how they do it, or is...
We did, so the HUP valuation, there at this point, we recorded it at NAV, that was reported in the audit reports. There wasn't any evidence to indicate that it shouldn't be that. We did discuss those numbers with our oil and gas valuation team. We considered what was happening at 12/31/21 related to those companies. And I understand, at this point that information's a little dated, so there's things that have happened since then that make maybe make it feel a little different at this point. But since we have to record it at fair value at that date, considering what was happening in the market, what we were seeing with other oil and gas entities, there wasn't any reason not to record it at the audited number.
Okay. Thank you.
When does this report go on our website?
We have to finalize it. And I believe the audit report is done, but they still need the representation letter signed from us. And I think, is that the only thing?
That is the only thing we need from you.
And then as far as the annual report, the ACFR, we need to finalize that as well.
Okay.
So it'll be within the next week or couple of weeks.
Anything else? I would like to just say, you know, publicly that we appreciate the work you guys do. You guys are fantastic business partners. I don't think everyone appreciates the supply-demand dynamic that exists in their world right now. So they're having to work a lot harder now and being asked to do more with fewer resources. So just think of the restaurant you can't get in because they don't have enough staff. It's that on steroids in the public accounting world right now for, you know, a variety of reasons. So we really, really appreciate what you guys do. And you know, we look at all the external business partners we have, and you guys are on our creme de la creme.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Nick, I wanted to thank you both and your team for this start and stop nature of our audit. I know that it's very difficult that you start the audit, you go away for months and months and months, and then, you know, we call you up one day and say, okay, hurry up, we're ready, drop everything. And you do a great job with that. We appreciate it, and hopefully someday we won't have to do that anymore.
Thank you. Thank you.
We need a motion to go ahead and approve the issuance of the 2021 audit report, subject to the final review and approval by BDO, which I think we're, you know, receiving, and Kelly is our executive director. So we have a
approval.
Yep. We have a second.
Second.
I'll
all
second.
In favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Sure. Now Brenda's going to talk about some of the differences in the audit from the unaudited numbers that you.
I want to know how Melissa's designed this year's report. It's like a huge unveiling. so.
Well, I hope you like it.
I know I'm going to love it. I just am curious what it's going to be.
It's that nice?
Had you in mind?
Well, I'm going to just highlight a few things from the audited financials before we get to the annual comprehensive report. Bear with me while we're trying to make this work. Trying to get to page 38.
Page 36, yeah, 36, 38.
I think. John, are you helping me get to page 38, please?
38 is the key to.
It's the diligent.
No, 38.
It's the diligent page number.
If you'll talk for us, I'll try to get it.
Okay, perfect.
I don't know why it's. I've only got that page.
Perfect. And one more. Okay, for me. There we go. So I'm just briefly going to go through the audited financials. Again, I'll add my thanks to Nick and Kelly. For Jill and Matt's hard work in helping us complete the audit of the financial statements. As you look at the audited financial statements, the first thing you're going to see are the BDO reports here on page 38. This one on page 38 is where their opinion can be found, saying that, it presents fairly in all material respects. And a couple of pages in, you'll also find their report on internal controls. The next section you'll see is management's discussion and analysis. It is 7 pages in length, and it provides a high-level summary of the activities of the plan during the last couple of years. If you have limited time, this is where I would always suggest that you go, is you start with the management discussion and analysis. One thing that you'll find here in, or the first thing here I want to point out, is the combining statements of fiduciary net position. This presentation shows a 3-year comparison, and the net position of the plan at 2021 is $2.17 billion. The net position increased year over year by $216 million, due primarily to investment gains, which were partially offset by benefit payments exceeding contribution payments. I originally presented the fourth quarter 2021 financials at the February board meeting, and at that time, till the final, there has been an increase in net position of $166 million, and again, that is due to changes in the investment value from the end of the year till now when we finished. The next one is the combining statements of changes in fiduciary net position. The 2021 city contribution amount increased by $3.9 million, or 2.4% over last year, due to an increase in the biweekly floor amount. The member contributions increased by $1.2 million, or 2.1% over last year, and that's because of increased salaries. And as we look at net income from investing activities, it increased $333 million year over year, and again, that's due to the appreciation in the fair value of primarily the private equity assets. As we move on, I want to mention this chart, which shows a member breakdown in the distributions. You'll see we are highlighting in gray the monthly benefit payments, in red the drop annuity payments, and in blue other drop payments. As you can see, most of the distributions are monthly benefit payments, and they increased $4.2 million, or 1.6% year-over-year. An additional 92 retirees and beneficiaries began receiving payments in 2021. I want to show you here on page 50 a different presentation of the financials. So, same information that you saw back on 43 and 44. This one has a little more detail, and it has the added feature of separating out the combined plan from the supplemental plan so you can see the financial statements. This is not a presentation that we show very often, so I just wanted to call your attention to the fact that it is available here in the audit to financials where you can see the two plans broken apart. Couple of other things to highlight here. Here on page 52, just information about the membership. So here on 52, combined plan membership, the non-active members increased by 98 year over year, and the active members decreased by 18 year over year. So more non-active, so more retirees and beneficiaries, fewer active members here in the combined plan. And on the next page, you'll see the same information only for the supplemental plan which had increases both in active and non-active of 5 each. The next section is the notes to the financials. And I specifically want to mention note 3, which is on page 62.
And while we get there,
note 3 is all about the investments. And it provides some detailed comparisons and information about investment values. As we look here on this page, you'll see the investments comparison year over year by the short term, by all of the different asset categories here. So we had $2.1 million in our investment portfolio in 2021, and that's up by $244 million over the prior year. So also included, as well as this fair value table here, you'll see fixed income maturity tables, which will show, again, comparisons, but you'll see both years and the years to maturity here. And then you'll also see some foreign currency. These are just a couple of things that maybe are not in the normal presentation that you would see during the year, and it is something that I just want to call your attention to here. Kind of lastly, I want to go to page 83 and look at required supplementary information. So required supplementary information has some good trending schedules here as you look at what has gone on with the system. So in this case, you're looking at the combined pension plan. There's also, you'll see 8 years. We initially will have 10 years worth of data here. And then you'll also see the same information for the supplementary plan. In this section, you'll see not only these 8 years of trending, but you'll see history of plan changes. You'll find information about investment returns. And the final page is detailed expense information that gives you a little more breakdown of the expenses for 2021. Are there any questions about the 2021 audited financials?
Okay. We have a motion to authorize the executive director to issue the 2021 annual comprehensive financial report upon its finalization.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much, Brenda.
You are so welcome. So are we ready for the big unveiling?
Uh-huh.
The next thing we're going to talk about is our annual comprehensive financial report. And for some of you, perhaps, you may be wondering, which we commonly call the ACFR, what is this? So here we go. This is our 2021 annual report, and it is a thorough and detailed presentation of the pension system's financial condition. It reports on the pension's activities and balances for each year. This year, our theme is CRANE, as it represents progress in the city of Dallas, and we believe that represents progress for DPFP as well. What you're seeing here on this cover page is a picture of the union, which was one of our investments that was successfully completed and monetized by the system. Throughout, you'll also see some other pictures of the union. You'll also see Museum Tower. And we're excited to say that this year, Museum Tower sold the last unit, and we have completed that investment project as well.
So you need a rear view mirror there.
Is it identified as a museum tower in there?
Pardon me?
I said, are the pictures identified as a museum tower?
No, but you, it's pretty.
You
know, I
go to page 109.
So let's get started here and briefly go through the ACFR and tell you what can be found in this report.
So while she's getting to her first page, we prepare this report under the standards of the Government Finance Officers Association. They have a checklist that really guides the content of what has to be in here. We can add more things as long as they don't distract from the message. But the order, what kind of how things are presented, those are required to get the annual award.
Thank you, Kelly. Going to start here with the table of contents, again, for those of you who only see it once a year, or maybe this is your first time. There are five sections in the ACFR: the introduction, the financial information, investment information, actuarial information, and statistical information. And this is always just a good reference to say, where can I find what I'm looking for? And that's there on page 107 for those of you who are following along. So let's start with the introduction section. See if that looks familiar to anyone there. This is one of the museum tower.
Should have a completed project.
The first thing in the introduction section is the transmittal letter. The transmittal letter discusses DPFP, major initiatives, funding status, the 2021 financial results, the investment portfolio, and other important information. And again, I would encourage you, if you have limited time to spend your time with the transmittal letter. It's only 7 pages long, and you'll get a nice high-level summary of what's gone on in the past year. The other thing that I do want to point out, you'll see our award certificate here from GFOA. We've received that award certificate for the last 7 years. We will submit this report and expect to receive it for the following year as well. Along with the GFOA report, we also received the Public Pension Standards Award for administration. After the transmittal letter, there's information about the Board of Trustees and all of your smiling faces. Oops, let's see, going the wrong way. Pardon me. All of your smiling faces there, all of our new smiling faces here, and then it ends with an org chart and our professional advisors. That's the first section, introductory, or the introduction. Next is the financial section. This section is identical to the audited financial statements that we just reviewed, word for word, period for period, comma for comma. So I'm not going to go over this since we already have, but you'll just know that it is identical to what we have already looked at. So if we'll move down to page 187 for those of you who are following along with us. And that'll take us to the investment section. Almost there. And there's the investment information. The first thing that you'll see in the investment section is the letter from Makita. And after that, you'll see information about investment performance. And one of the first things that we have there is the investment table by asset class that includes 1, 3, 5, and 10-year returns, and it's measured against their representative benchmark. So for 2021, the investment return was 5% on the overall portfolio. This also continues on to the next page.
Brenda, I'm going to mention it later, but that paragraph at the top is the methodology for performance reporting, and just our official performance, what I show in the portfolio update, what Makita shows, has a quarter lag for private markets. So this kind of goes through exactly how they do that. The audit number includes, you know, everything on a trued up 2021.
What page number is that? So
it's
193.
Basically, I mean, all the privates, when it comes to performance reporting, on a quarter lag, adjust for any cash flows that occurred during that quarter. So everything else in this report is not on a lag. Performance is on a lag. So I'm
thank you, Ryan.
That's standard practice. In the
We made the switch, I think, in like 13 for a while. We were kind of waiting on everything, and it made more sense to do the lag.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate that. This just completes that table. And then as we move to page 196, you'll see information on the asset allocation. Here the comparison is the current allocation, which would mean the 12/31/2021 allocation, against the target allocation. So for equity at 12/31, we had 58.5%, and the target allocation was 6%. So this is a nice comparison of the asset allocation. As we go to the next page, you'll see the asset allocation by a broad category comparing year over year. So when you look at equity, equity was 43.7% in 2020, and it was 58.5% in 2021. So it's a nice comparison of where we've come in the past year. Below that is that same asset allocation, just broken down more by the asset class. The next is the evolution of the asset allocation. I know Ryan shows this from time to time. I like this chart, as I think it's a great graphical representation of, in 2016, when you looked at global equity, less than 10% was global equity, and to where we are now at 40% just for the global equity. So, again, it tracks our progress and what we've been able to accomplish in the last few years. There are sections and charts on fees broken down in a variety of ways that you can look at that. I like the chart, the table on page 201. If you're interested in who our largest public equity and fixed income holdings are, there they are. There they are on 201, and a list of all of our investment managers. So, again, a lot of good investment information in this section, maybe some information that you don't see on a regular ongoing basis, but that we present to you on an annual basis. The next section is the actuarial section. Last month, Siegel came in and presented the actuarial information. We take the highlights from that and we put it into this actuarial section. First thing is funding information. Just as we talked about last month, the combined pension funded ratio declined to 41.1% as of 1/1/2022. And that's from 41.6% at 1/1/21. What you'll also find in here is a lot of information about actuarial assumptions and methods. Those are on pages 210 through 215. Just want to point out just kind of some of the tables that you might see in here that could be interesting to you on page 213. Years of service, they show the turnover by police and fire. So, for example, if you wanted to say what is the turnover at 10 years, you could look at police, 3.5%, fire, 1%. Again, not information that you see all the time, but it's certainly here and also in the actuarial report. I'm going to end this section on page 219. Here is member information. Always interested in the member information. 10 years of historical information there. So if you look at the combined plan for 2022, there were 5,088 active members with average annual salary of $86,000. So that's, again, just a highlight and a taste of what you could find here in the actuarial section. The last section is the statistical section. The statistical section provides historical perspective, context, and detail, and it gives you 10-year schedules. You'll see included in this section a term called consolidated plan. So we have the combined plan, also kind of known as the regular plan, the supplemental plan, and as we're doing analysis on those plans, sometimes to protect our members' information, we combine the plans together, and so you'll see that as the consolidated plan, and know that is the combination of both the combined plan and the supplemental plan together. There's a lot of good trending information here. The first thing it starts with is just a description of what are the schedules that are here in this statistical section that are financial trends and operating trends. So it describes that for you. Then you have the changes in fiduciary net position. Again, we saw those earlier back on pages 43, 44. This is a 10-year snapshot, both for the combined plan and the supplemental plan. We looked a little bit at distributions earlier. Here is a 10-year snapshot. I just want to mention the anomaly that you see there in 2017 is the $600 million drop withdrawal that happened during that time, and that is that anomaly. But good information on distributions by type, service retirements, beneficiaries, disabilities, and so forth. Next thing, benefit recipients by type. If you're interested in benefit recipients by type, and I'm on page 232 now, the breakdown by dollars, what's the breakdown by type? So if we were to go to, let's say, 3501 to 4000, you see there are 423 members who are receiving that benefit. 350 of them are service retirement, 35 are disabilities. So, again, additional information maybe in a different way than what you've seen before. Same way here on when you look at yearly retirement, you'll see information. So if we were to look at 2021, we would see that we had, which is at the very bottom of the page, and then you see the years of service going across, we had 166 retirements in 2021. And based on their years of service, so of those 166 retirements, 45 had years of service in the 21 to 25-year category. 46 retirements had years of service in the 26 to 30. So, again, 10 years of history here for you to look at. And then we'll finish here again with membership information, because I think that that's always interesting to the members. If you look at the membership count for the combined plan, active 4,812, active drop retirees, you can see across there, and there's 10 years of information here, both for the combined and for the supplemental plan. That is the end of the report. You'll see there, this report will be posted on the website when it is complete. Prior years, going back to 2014, are posted on the website. We'll have hard copies available for everyone at the January board meeting. And if you prefer, we can mail a hard copy to you, or we can send you a soft copy via email. Are there any questions about the ACFR or the Annual Comprehensive Financial Report?
I should have waited for this to do the motion, so if anyone wants to un-gate or yay, go ahead and apply. I will caution everyone, it's not a law, but there's a 15-year guideline on your picture in the audit. And I think some of you are really close, so just saying, you're going to have to watch that, although I think you can monkey with the dates a little bit to claim that it was a more recent photo than it actually is. All right, we're going to go ahead and move to the audit committee report. I'm chair of the committee. I'll go ahead and do that. We met with Joe and Matt, with Kelly and Brenda, and then without them, and everything they said, we affirm. I think the only thing that I wanted to flag was I asked about, their opining on any sort of solvency issues, and according to kind of the accounting standards, they only really look forward 1 year, whereas if you say, non-issue for us, because of the funding ratio, if you look forward a decade, you might have different views, but just the way that they're looking at it, there's not an issue. And then the other thing is that the supply-demand in that world right now is that they have more business than they can ever handle. There's a shortage of qualified personnel. There's an unbelievable amount of poaching going on between the firms. Their costs have gone up a lot. We're within a multi-year RFP with them, but we're going to have a discussion with them on rates and all that. And not saying that's obviously a decision for Kelly to make. This is not our job. Our job is to let her do her job. But we are very mindful that they're a great business partner and wanted to work for both sides. But they gave very positive feedback on the team and everything going on. So I was very satisfied. Armando, you or Nancy, have any additional comments? You guys are both on the committee as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's very reassuring that the remarks were positive.
Yeah, it seems like every year the one thing that they reaffirm is the transparency and how easy it is to work with staff. So that's reassuring to Nancy's point. We have been hearing, Bill, when you were back in the chair, years ago. but there is a labor shortage. And at some point, I'm a little leery that that's going to catch up to us.
Yeah.
So we need to be prepared to take some alternative implement some alternative processes, consider some other things. So, but otherwise, overall, really good, really great meeting and a good report.
We did that last year. We allowed them to do some of the ticking and checking without the personal confidential information.
Right.
Offshore.
Right. No,
that helped
that it was offshore.
Yeah, it was offshore.
Yeah.
So that helped keep our costs down. So.
You might have to expand those efforts.
Yeah, you may.
You mean outside of Texas or just outside of the country?
Offshore. Going to the Gulf.
Okay.
Instead of
where you are.
God's country, right?
All right. Just everyone Watch that picture years thing, okay? That's our biggest.
The rule should be if you're not silver in the picture and you are now, you should change it.
Because my picture is only 2 years old. Someone can't take my 13 years and apply to it. Okay. Kelly, monthly contribution report.
Okay. On page 145 is your standard monthly contribution report. Again, this month there's not a whole lot to say about it. Everything, the trends are still consistent with what you've seen so for the last couple of years, actually. This is October's data. There was two pay periods in October. The actual contributions based on actual comp pay were $11,782,771. And in addition to that, the floor gave us an extra $303,303,229. Next year, the floor is not going to be meaningful anymore, so that will stop. But they're still struggling with hiring over at the city. There are 171 bodies down from their hiring plan estimate, but because they did the pay increases, the dollars are coming in above their actual hiring plan estimate at the time. So no news here. It's the trend continues, which is good news.
Okay.
The next item is the also the monthly report that you see on travel and education. Carol has listed, I think, 7 classes here for you. If anybody's interested in attending in any of these classes, let us know. We'll add you to the agenda for board approval, and Carol can get you signed up. These are the TechSpurs and NCPurs classes are pretty good to attend. I think they're pretty valuable for the trustees. If you're interested in that, just let us know. And unless there's any questions on these, I can turn it over to Ryan.
Yeah.
All right. So we get the portfolio update, and then we have Leo and Steve Hart from Makita here to cover the private markets item that we couldn't get to last month because of the phone difficulties, and then the performance reports for Q3 on the public and Q2 on the private side. So starting with portfolio update, as always, liquidation of private assets remains top focus. We've gotten $100 million year-to-date from the private portfolio. The biggest recent one was $26 million from AEW in early November. About $40 million of these proceeds have been redeployed into public equity portfolios since we put quite a bit of that money back to work. We're still in the private on the safe reserve. We'll cover that with more detail later. Recent rebalancing actions, we did the Ashmore redemption on EM debt end of September, funded MetLife, the new manager there. And then recently, in the middle of November, we put $26 million into small cap equity, largely coming from that AEW distribution. With that rebalancing, we had $47 million that we could have redeployed. We looked at it, we held $21 million back in cash, which gave us a bit more runway on the safe reserve payment. So estimated year-to-date return on the total portfolio down 1.4%. What's bleeding into that is the Huff and Lone Star write-ups in Q4 with the lag, as I mentioned earlier, down about 9% on the public portfolio, which is about two-thirds of the total assets right now. Just wanted to mention, we brought it up last meeting, but there's no one on the blackout list of entities that we are currently managers that we're looking at or updating contracts on. Typically, we put that on the drive for you guys to see who's on that. I think going forward to get it more in front of everyone's faces, we'll probably email it. If someone's on the list in months where no one is on the blackout list like now, we're not doing a search, I'll just say that there's no one on the list. Okay, looking at the bridge chart, I need to update there at the top, but there's the end of November, not October. We're at $1.86 billion in AUM. That's up from $1.79 at the end of October. This is the equity market drawdown chart. This is as of on Tuesday. So one thing to point out different here, you know, kind of our fourth leg down and back up, and it dropped a little bit. Markets are down about 3% more since the beginning of November. This is the first time, I believe, that we pulled this chart in 2022 where the U.S. with the S&P is actually underperforming international and the EFA, And then you can see on the EM, they've caught up quite a bit in the last month. So we're seeing a little bit of divergence between EM, TEP with the NASDAQ, and then the rotation performance from the U.S. has been harder in the last few weeks than international.
It's sort of hard to see that on this chart. But
yeah, I mean, it's busy. I'll use the pointer if you need it to.
That's it.
There you go. But yeah, I mean, it's minor, but it's just the first time that those two have been flipped looking at it. This is showing, we've showed that most months this year, the average intra-year decline on the S&P 500 is 14%. Our biggest decline this year is 25%, whereas this was at the end of November, down 14%. I think this chart compared to the next one, which is new this month, is showing kind of the stark difference in how abnormal this is for the stock market versus the bond market. So this is the same type of data showing on U.S. ag bonds with the average intra-year decline and then the current decline in U.S. bonds. So average intra-year is 3.1%. It's positive in 42 out of 46 years. So we are, you know, magnitudes bigger drop in bonds than we've seen any time in the last 46 years. Looking at performance of our public portfolio, a few things to point out here. So Boston Partners, value manager, still performing pretty well compared to the bench. So how do I do with the spotlight system?
Back on Eastern Shore, they've been underperforming for 3 years now?
So, yes, we haven't had them for 3 years. We've only had them for about a year now.
Okay,
If you remember, we hired them. They're a quality manager, and it was really like the 2020 COVID recovery with a lot of junk stocks rallying in their quality manager. They're underperforming quite a bit when we hired them over the near term. They're also underperforming since we've hired them a little bit.
I think for 3 years, you just want to put not applicable.
We've kind of made the decision just to show kind of the longer term on all these. There's quite a few managers that are new in the portfolio that we are showing. Like anyone with a footnote next to them, basically, we're showing the longer term. But we know that, you know, we haven't been with them that long. So Invesco, they're the growth manager that struggled year to date. November's markets were up quite a bit. They outperformed by 3.7%, which is what we would expect to see and like to see for a manager that's underperformed on the way down. I just want to mention, we talked about it a little bit last month. We're going to have them come in person next Thursday, to the IAC to do a portfolio review. So if any board members are interested in hearing from Invesco, they'll be here next week. So I just let the listeners know if you want to listen in or attend that.
Well, we probably need to know that in advance because of Open Meeting Act requirements and things like that. We'll need Josh's opinion as to how many people can be there and how many can talk and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we've done it before where if anyone wants to attend, you know, if we have more than a quorum, they just can't ask questions. And then emerging markets up 14% in the month of November. RBC's performed really well kind of over the long term and especially this year outperforming on the downside. Any other questions on public manager performance?
One thing that I would be interested in from Akita is that I would like to know if you have other managers on your platform that have performed really well in these various asset classes, or, you know, top one or two or three. I understand the gap between index returns and our specific returns, but what I would like to see would be our manager returns that, you know, all of our managers are on through your platform, meaning you guys provide some oversight over those relative to the best option, and we could look at it, you know, not on a month, but maybe on a year-to-day basis or, you know, over the last year or 3 years or something. I don't really have a feel for how
the best performing managers have done relative to our managers, relative to the index. So I would like to get some data on that in the future.
Megan, we can certainly work with staff and put together some materials
okay.
to share with you. Just to preface, Makita's philosophy is one of inclusiveness. So we actually work with a lot of managers. There's a lot of clients that may have the manager that they are the only one using them. So we don't have a focused list of 30 or 40 names in each category where all clients have to choose from those. As a result, we have a wide universe of managers. Because of that, there's always going to be some that perform really well and some that lag. But we will provide as much information.
Find something, pick the top three or something. I just would like to get a sense of how big of a gap that is because I don't have a feel for it.
Yeah. And it goes by asset class, and we look at that by quartile. So we look top quartile versus bottom
okay,
quartile.
Okay, we can do it that way.
And
that,
we look
that,
five
yeah.
and then five.
That,
so, yeah, we'll
would,
do that.
Yeah, and when you get to the performance report, like in the Makita reports, which is a little bit dated information, that they have quartile ranking for each asset
okay.
class and how our managers are performing against
okay.
the whole investment universe.
But you sort of got to define a time frame. You don't want short term. You want 3, 4, 5
yeah.
years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So on the safety reserve, we're at 129 compared to target of 158. As I mentioned, with the $21 million that we did not redeploy and held back in cash, that gave us runway of how much money we have in the safety reserve to pay benefit payments from November of next year through the end of 23, probably into January. Bottom right, looking at cash flow projections, we should be good on cash probably through end of Q1, so we'll look at if we have new money coming in, whether we want to keep in cash or pull more money over from IRM and short-term core bonds into the cash portfolio. This detail on kind of the equity portfolio and asset allocation, we've added that percent of target. This is kind of guiding us on where to put money back into the equity portfolio as we're doing rebalancing actions. So with the new money coming into Eastern Shore and Global Alpha, and we invested in those managers to kind of fund them halfway to target. They're getting a little bit closer to target. So I think as the money is coming back into the equity portfolio, it's going to be a combination of like small cap and the Northern Trust passive investment. Try to get everyone kind of pro-rata to target. So this is the investment review calendar for this month and then kind of the schedule that we stuck to last year on rotating through the asset classes, starting with real estate. On some of the bigger ones, we brought the managers in. Some we've covered at the staff level, giving an update to you guys on the asset class, and then working into the public portfolios as well. We did public equity last month. But just wanted to check in with the board on the cadence, depth of these reviews, and anything you want to hear more about or less about from staff on the investment portfolio. Just any feedback on that or just let me know afterwards. So this month we've scheduled the private equity and debt review. We've done it, kind of, we're going to do it within the portfolio update. You hear about a lot of these all the time, so the big material one, Top and Lone Star, that's what I hear too much about. So there's a few other ones I wanted to hit on. I talked to Nick the other day, and on Hoffa, I want to kind of cover what it actually is, because I feel like you guys hear a lot about the issues with Hoffa and the audit and the valuation, but just kind of a reset, high level on what that portfolio, what's in that portfolio, and then I'll cover two other ones. So Hoff Energy, there's one remaining investment, one big company that's in Hoff Energy. It's 2,000 net acres in the Eagle Ford Shale, so South Texas. We have a working interest in about 60 wells down there. Most of the value in that land is in proven undeveloped acreage. So it's wells that are not yet drilled, but they've proven out reserves there. So that part of the valuation, given the nature of the DCF, what needs to go into producing those wells, is the most volatile and highly dependent on future oil prices. So that's why we see these massive swings in valuation from year to year. We have a 20% interest in the fund, valued at 174. This is as of Q2 valuation, and it's currently in a sales process. So we're hopeful that we'll get a sale at some
Do we really think he's trying to sell it, or do we think he's just hanging on to it?
I think he's trying to sell it. I think it's a matter of, you know, buyer pool willing to put a lot of capital into developing reserves right now. So
he still wants to, he wants to end his, I mean, he's done with his investment work. I mean, he wants to just sort of run out his, you know, finish up his portfolio stuff and kind of ride off in the sunset.
So the other two, Industry Ventures, in the middle of the page there is a 2016 vintage, $5 million commitment. It is a venture capital, kind of secondary and fund-to-fund structure, so they invest in direct fund of, like, fund investments. They buy secondary fund investments from other venture capital funds, and they do some direct co-investments. So it's a, kind of split about a third between those three categories. So we get pretty broad exposure to VC through that fund. We have exposure to over 1,000 underlying companies. IRR on this investment is about 30% net since inception, but only 20% ratio distributed to paid in capital. So most of that value is kind of on the books right now. And given the space they're in, we haven't seen a big markdown yet, so I would expect to see one maybe a year in. And given that they're a fund-to-fund and secondary fund, I think their valuation is a little bit dependent on the marks of the underlying fund investments they have. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something there. And the other one to mention, Riverstone, that is an energy private debt fund that we made an investment in 2016 as well. $10 million commitment. Four investments in that portfolio remain. They expect to have everything wound up by the end of next year. 6% IRR, and we've gotten $2.5 million back from that portfolio in 2022. So they're actively distributing capital back to us. So any other questions on any of the other names on this page? Hudson and Highland are kind of in wind down and immaterial. All right.
Any update on portfolio sales from OnStar?
The Woodlawn sale closed, so we got proceeds from that in September. We had a monthly update call with them. It was early November, and I have another one scheduled, so we're kind of doing the monthly portfolio reviews. There's two sales or companies in an active sales process. Nothing is, like, imminent, but there's, I guess, it's positive news from a portfolio performance, company performance standpoint. And, you know, the big one there is Continental. Like, if they're going to get to that threshold of sales to remain or that they need to get to by the end of 23, that's going to be, you know, that alone would probably get them there. Otherwise, they have to sell pretty much everything else. So that's the one we're keeping an eye on. So I think probably, you know, towards into Q1 into Q2 next year, we should probably give you guys a more thorough update on kind of what's going on there and how it's looking towards the benchmarks that we set for them, settlement. Okay, moving on. Leo?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. First of all, apologies. I was supposed to be here last month, but I felt sick. I tried calling in, and we had that technology issue. So I'm glad we're here today, and we can revisit this topic. I'm actually joined by my colleague, Steve Hart, who is the head of private equity. And Makita happens to be seated not far from my office in Carlsbad. I've attended a meeting in the past or two and joined on some video meetings.
Yep. Good to see everybody again.
Great. So I'm going to kick it up, and then I'm going to turn it over to Steve. I think the big picture is this is a very important asset class for most investors. Most peers have anywhere from 10 to 15% allocated to private equity. Of course, some investors have a lot more. And it's been a driver of returns. So some funds have really been very accretive as a result of success within the private equity performance. So I think the long-term strategy for investors like yourself, even your own long-term strategic asset allocation over the years, has been correct to allocate to private assets such as private equity. The problem in your case, as you know, has been just execution. Now, Makita, I know you've asked us, I've heard the questions, you could hear me, but I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. So Makita's quite experienced investing in private markets. We've been doing that since the late 90s. We oversee probably something like $150 billion, bifurcated into two kind of assets, one being for the large state funds, think of the CalPERS of the world, and the other for, you know, smaller, more nimble funds. I would call those under $5 billion, where you can have a lot more options in terms of the funds that you can go because you're only committing maybe $5, $10, $20 million per fund. About 50 investment professionals across multiple offices and plenty of peers, probably that you asked us in the past. The closest I can think of to you would be El Paso Fire and Police, similar in size, and we've been working with them on private equity since 2009. So in our presentation, which today we just hit on some of these pages, this is similar content to what we did with the IAC back in September, and we will welcome any questions along the way, but it starts with policy and procedures, and as we see, that is mostly what I think would be a great outcome for the next 6 to 12 months. I think we're still early to be deploying capital, and it is paramount to have the right framework for you to do it successfully in the coming years. As you know well, if you go in and something doesn't work out, it takes a lot of time and resources to fix that. So starting from the top, going back to the policy statement, some members of the IAC pointed at this. So let's revisit what is the role of this asset class, of the broader private market, what targets should we have? Should we revisit the asset allocation? The last time we did it, and we settled on those 5, 5, and 5 targets for PE, real estate, and natural resources. It was a couple of years ago. It had a specific rationale for that. On a go-forward basis, it may change. So that would be an important aspect probably to do and accomplish in 2023 at some point in time. Once that is determined, looking at pacing, one of the issues that we notice is a very moving pattern of committing to capital over, you know, the 2000s, for example. Some years deploying little capital, some years putting a lot. So we believe a methodical approach, so coming up with a annual commitment amount, and then a number of funds to invest in a year, and then methodically doing that without timing the market, without making any bets on sectors, geography, any concentration like that. So that essentially would provide you with a roadmap that you can follow over the years. So ultimately, it boils down to implementation, and we can discuss today, our views. We know you have some specific aspects in your statutes that you have to follow. For example, we now have a minimum number of votes of the board to make any decision as it relates to alternative investments. So with that, I'll pause. That's the framework for today's conversation. Steve, any comments you want to make about private equity, what you see in the asset class, what you see in terms of success across our clients and investors in general, and given your knowledge about the client, any comments or observations?
Sure. Happy to do so. Thanks for having me. So I think as Leo points out, there's several aspects that need to be considered as you're moving forward with the private equity plan. So just outlining here, setting objectives ahead of time, knowing where you want to go, what are the roles and goals that you want to achieve as investing in the plan, and developing an effective and efficient go-forward plan to address that and achieve those goals. So unpacking that, what I mean on that is, effective as Leo is mentioning, every client is a little bit different, and how you go about being able to allocate the capital into the asset class needs to be customized to how you actually operate and the way that you are structured, what amount of delegation staff has, if any, how decisions are made. All this needs to be in thought through as you develop your plan. And
And efficient, what I'm meaning there is from a costs perspective. And there could be headline costs, and then it's not really hidden costs, but they're not well-presented costs. So you're certainly aware in private equity there's the management fees, but there's also carried interest or profit shares. And to really think through and understand at the end of the day what all the costs are going to be in the particular execution plan that you decide to move forward with. And then, importantly, it's got to be quality assets, right? You need to be able to fill that portfolio up with assets along the plan that has been put together, where the asset class are. So that's, you know, what we and, you know, others do is to identify what those quality assets are and to be able to bring them into the portfolio. I'll highlight a couple of other things as well. You know, obviously, the private equity program is part of the overall plan, and to be thinking through how this execution is going to work as part of the overall plan. So certain things to think about in terms of this execution. First is the liquidity profile, right? So these are assets that draw capital over time, and making sure that but it's not well scheduled. You can't, you know, identify a date on the calendar when, you know, X manager is going to draw Y amount of capital. So understanding what that looks like and how that's going to integrate with the client's overall liquidity program is important. Another is the asset class exposures. So you, like other clients, already have certain exposures in place, and making sure that how the portfolio, the private equity portfolio, is carried out needs to be developed in conjunction with where you all are today in terms of your asset classes and about how things develop sort of over time. Another is in the asset class exposures. In some areas, there's in each of these asset classes, there's ways to do it in public markets and ways to do it in private markets, and being coordinated to make sure the exposures are effectively executed and are in conjunction with your overall plan is important. So obviously, you have some real estate, there's some new real estate. Private debt is one that can be in both public and private, and being thoughtful about how that gets executed across the total plan is important to think through. And then, importantly, is just timing. You know, how this is going to roll out. It's going to be over a multi-year period to build the plan and execute to build the whole portfolio. So those are a few things that I'd say that need to be thought about as you're putting together the overall program in place. I'm happy to stop there and so get a touch.
In terms of the asset classes under the private debt umbrella, how many do you typically see in a pension fund this size in terms of subcategories?
In private debt, you said?
In the private equity portfolio.
Right. We think of private equity in general as in three buckets, and it's the type of companies that are there, but it's more important what is the value creation strategy that the manager is looking to try to achieve when they're making that kind of investment. So in venture capital, it's a small, high-growing company. You're finding somebody that's disruptive in the marketplace and that's going to take market share and replace it. There's growth capital where managers in generally are just looking to quickly grow their company, but they may be, you know, at or near profitability. And then there's buyouts where there can be value transformation of a particular company. It might be an unloved asset from a multinational that doesn't get appropriate attention as part of that, and it could be part of a specified on its own kind of company. So we think of three large buckets when we think about private equity. And then within there, there's a number of different dimensions in terms of the way to build that asset class. So one is certainly by industry. We find that generally specialists in a particular industry have more insights and more capabilities to be able to, across the different approaches there, to generate strong returns. There's geography is another one. There's some that are over in Europe or some that are in the United States in different locations. So there's a number of different dimensions that we think about how to build that portfolio. And Leo, you may just the roadmap page there, maybe that would be helpful. So that back one. Back, So here's just a illustrative purpose. When we go through and think about a building a portfolio for clients, we design, just talk about together ahead of time a roadmap of where this might go. And this is just illustrative and talking about different percentages. But the idea is that you don't need to do anything in any particular order, but you have a sense going in where you might want to get your exposures. And you can see in here that at the end of the day, there's a lot of diversification because across the different strategies and types and approaches that are there. So
what page are you on? Because I saw part of that, but we're
284.
284.
Yeah, 284, sorry.
So it's in the appendix. Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a way that you think about ahead of time to provide some guidance on where things would go. And by having the different strategies there, as well as the implied diversification, you can see that there's not too much that's going to go to any one particular manager or strategy, and helps to build a diversified portfolio, which at the end of the day, looking to try to achieve a certain rate of return on this pool of assets that'll be effective and consistent over time.
I know, Ryan, as we go down this road, I think we have projected what our assets will be based on the actuarial assumptions and everything, but then we should apply that 5% to just see what are we talking about,
Even
in the planning stage. Because, my concern a little bit is just I think it's a great asset class, but 5% of $2 billion is $100 million over time with diversification. Just how much can we really get involved in?
Yeah, like this is probably overly complex and overly diversified for the amount that we're talking about right now. So I think that's a big consideration for us is,
And liquidity is going to be a big consideration.
Yeah, liquidity.
We're still going to be a...
And then at 5%, and we also have the 5% to real estate to consider.
Yep.
Right now, the 5% to ag is with Hancock and their portfolio. But, how complex and how much time and resources should we spend on something that's 5% that may grow over time, but also how, what is the right bite size for commitments and how many different underlying fund investments do you need?
And then a second level is if we get a big infusion of cash somehow, just how we would think of that going forward. We're probably a little early for that. But
yeah. I would say longer term, we're going to go through asset allocation again, but, 5-7 years down the road, I can see that those allocations of privates going up. We're probably underweight compared to peers on our private allocation, but that's much longer term.
Yeah, you're definitely underweight, and that was purposely designed. As you recall, when we came on board, you had already a plan. You wanted to meaningfully decrease your exposure to a liquid asset. We knew it wouldn't go to zero, but that was the target to aim for so that then we can rebuild over time in a much more successful way. Peers are at least 10%, I would say, for public funds on private equity alone. So you'll be meaningfully underweight. And so if private equity, that's okay, and everything else remains constant, you will lag peers, and that's okay. You should need to understand that private equity has been a driver. If that continues, then that explains performance.
Longer term, 10% is a normal number for both real estate and private equity, and how people are adding private debt on top of that. In some number, 2, 3, 4, 5%, whatever, but that's going to be a longer-term consideration.
Yeah. So will our check size limit our ability to access certain, top-tier performers? How do you manage that?
Yeah, I was just going to piggyback on that.
Okay.
So, because Nick asked for kind of a ranking of, highest-performing funds, but surely there's a minimum bite size to that. Or minimum investment to those types of funds, and so how does that, basically, we have to, contextualize what we're looking at and how we might be able to take advantage of investing in, in any given fund, but we're not going to be super large.
Yeah, but it's actually good news for you, so. if he had hundreds of billions of dollars to deploy per year, it becomes very challenging. You only are limited to the very large funds, which you wouldn't expect to be the top-performing funds. You're essentially getting market returns plus some variance. In your case, I would not be considered, I would not be worried about getting access to the top tier names if you execute properly. What do I mean by that? If you partner with the right group, that group should be able to provide that access, at least in the case of Nikita, and I'm going to let Steve provide more comments. We're probably deploying somewhere between $50 to maybe $100 million per fund, per private equity fund.
In aggregate across a number of our clients.
Okay.
Correct. And so we looked with Ryan, and we did some fairly simplistic modeling, but at the 5% allocation, if you do 4 to 6 funds per year, it may lead to about $6 to $9 million per fund. So adding that to whatever our aggregate number is per fund is not something that all of a sudden we're going to reach the Nikita capacity in any fund. So you would benefit from the 20-plus year relationships that we have with other clients that we've negotiated and accessed. And so from that perspective, even a smaller client that can put $1, $2, $3 million per fund benefit tremendously. If you were going on your own, you would not. But as you tag along some larger organization, which basically is the one interfacing with the general partner, not only would you get access, but you may get also preferential terms. Because as we negotiate capacity, as we commit more capital, we might get into fee breaks, we might sit on advisory boards, et cetera. So from our perspective, I think you're in a fairly good position.
Yep, I'd agree. You're not in this by yourself. You can certainly work with someone such as ourselves or others that can aggregate the. You could benefit from the resources of the wide reach of seeing the whole marketplace and the review process and experience to get down to, you know, what are the quality managers, and then once those are identified, to have your capital aggregated with demand from other clients to be able to participate in that investment. So we have clients that do it on their own, but they've got pretty large staffs to do all that work. As Leo mentions, their size is a benefit, but it's also a real consideration that there's a number of investments they just won't have access to because they're just frankly the manager can't take that, the GP can't take that capital because it's too big for them. They don't have room for anybody else. So those types of opportunities really get kind of moved over to the side, whereas for what you have, it can be aggregated and have the full range of high-quality opportunities.
You sort of have an advantage too, Ryan, having Rakesh from SMU on your investment advisory committee. They're about the same size, and they have gone through this over the last 5 years of implementing a program, and they've got people there. So, I mean, you've just got another resource that can give you some guidance as well.
Steve, real quick, what's your view on secondaries, both overall and maybe specifically for us?
Yeah. So I'd say that secondaries is has been a rapidly growing marketplace and across a number of dimensions. So just in terms of size, it certainly has grown. And there's been more and more participants playing in that marketplace, and it's developed in a couple of other ways as well. But for limited partners, it's I'd say that the bid-ask spread it's beneficial in that the bid-ask spread has tightened up, and that there's additional capital going in, and some of that's really being quite specialized. So we're seeing for the first time investors that are targeting infrastructure assets or real estate assets or energy assets. So rather than just being a general fund that will just buy kind of anything out there. So if you wanted to sell something, that marketplace is more liquid. On the other side, what we have seen for done for some of our clients, ones that might not have participated in private equity before or have been taking a break, is that investing in a secondary either fund or getting a portfolio can help them backfill some of their exposures, so that there's years that have not been invested in, but there's a way to kind of backfill that. And so that could be useful from that perspective as well. So from a strategic perspective, we tend not to do it too tactically to try to buy the secondaries and it's trying to time the market or something, but more as a strategic tool for some clients that are needing to backfill their exposures.
And returns are around the same?
Say again.
Returns are around the same?
What happens with the – because the should we say the ripening period for the underlying assets in a secondary is shorter. So it means that typically the IRR returns are quite attractive, but the multiples tend to be lower, right? So you're sort of buying a tree that already has the fruit on it, and some of it's already getting ripe. Whereas if you're investing in a fund, you're kind of putting a seed in the ground, it's got to grow. So that's kind of the idea, is the secondary, the fruit's already kind of on there.
Great analogy.
Good analogy, yeah.
Very good. And given our liquidity situation of not wanting to be tied up for 10, 12 years,
right,
that probably makes sense for some portion of whatever we would do.
Yeah. But in your case, the last investment you made was in 2016.
Yes,
so you certainly have several years where you have made no investments. If you want to make that diversification over time, secondaries, as we discussed, is likely one of your first order considerations for private equity to restart it.
Yeah, like two additional thoughts I have for secondaries is you get some diversification there, so you might feel a little more concentrated, simplistic with the rest of the allocation. And then, like that, I guess the one concern I have, and we can talk more about it, is just like if you're going into a secondary fund in the next year, are you buying into vintages in like 2021 where they overpaid for companies, or is that going to be kind of reflected into the prices that they're buying the fund interest at?
It's going to be, you know, people know where we are today,
yeah,
and they'll look through, and that's a benefit of the secondaries. You can see, you have a lot of transparency in what's already there, mm-hmm, and you can kind of see where those companies are and how they're doing, and take that into account in terms of the price.
One thing that I would be interested in is that the reason this you would go into this asset class is that it does something for you that other things don't do, or somehow it creates a 1+1=2 type scenario through the way things get commingled. So I would want to see whatever data you have on private equity versus public equity, so what have been the returns over time, and is it worth the illiquidity? Is it worth the higher fees? And is it worth that, you know, for instance, if you make a $10 million capital commitment to a private equity fund, I know it's different with secondaries, but in the other ones, you may have a multi-year drawdown, so you've earmarked the money, it hasn't been deployed yet. When they do returns, they say it from when they take it in, not from when you commit it, but at the same time then we have it sort of sequestered pending their drawdown. So I would also be interested in private markets excluding private equity, you know, where you have lower correlations and where those asset classes really do have the potential to do things that you can't do with your public portfolio. You know, I think about the timber investments, and Ryan, my recollection is that's a long-term winner for us that we've made a lot of money in, right?
No, it's the ag.
Oh, the ag, I'm sorry, the ag.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ag.
Timber, we've lost a lot of
money. Okay, excuse me.
We want almonds.
Yes. So, you know, I'd be interested in your guys' expertise in those non-equity markets, and there's, you know, a whole bunch of them. They're not as deep and is well known, but that would be part of it as well.
Yeah.
Nick, would it make sense to set a time frame, like a 10-year time frame, or?
Yeah, I mean, however they would want to show it, but I would want to incorporate those thoughts into it. Yeah.
Sure. Happy to do that. So, just a couple quick comments on the reason to do private equity really is down to performance. You want to try to get, you know, a higher rates of returns than you can otherwise get in publics. It can be, you can think about it as a bit of a completion strategy, as private equity tends to be at the smaller size companies than you have in your, you know, public equity indices. So you can think about its exposures into that. Some folks think about it as a way to access, you know, some international exposures. We're not advocating this now, but, you know, if you wanted to be in China, the only things you could do is kind of some state-owned companies. But if you wanted to have other exposure into China, you do it really through private equity. In terms of so that's really there, and you know, recognizing there is a lot of fee load there, we do look at the performance on a, you know, after fees basis, and it's, we'll provide some information, but it's been attractive over a long period of time. On the illiquidity side, you know, something to keep in mind, what we're seeing, you know, for El Paso, that I've been clients that have been committing to and investing in private equity for a long time. Essentially, what happens after the ramp-up period, if you look at the portfolio overall, after all, that the liquidity profile is kind of even to actually cash generative, that you're going to get more distributions out over time than you're going to be drawing capital. That's part of the performance. It takes a while to get there, but over a period of time, it becomes a cash generative asset once you reach sort of the target exposures. In terms of the non-controlled assets, non-correlated assets, I'd say we do that two ways. One is through the private markets and things like you'd mentioned, the natural resources. Typically, we're looking for exposure to inflation in that, trying to capture some inflation exposure there. Infrastructure is also has some positive exposure to inflation. Real estate can be as well. But then we do, I think Leo had talked about using some hedge funds and doing something called a risk mitigating strategy to build a portfolio that zigs when the rest of the market zag. That's a whole other topic to discuss, but just, you know, in terms of your question about how to build a portfolio of non-correlated assets, there's a couple of tools to try to do that, and I'd say it's another reason to be thoughtful about how the execution takes place and the different constituencies, consultants, advisors, they're going to be doing it, because it really should be done on a coordinated way so that you're not overstepping or missing opportunities.
Yeah. And then, you know, just the quality barometer, best to worst, is so much more
– yes.
Broad in all of these things. So how do you know you're with, you know, the A team? That's a big part of it. And then the other thing that I always, you know, I'd be deemed financially sophisticated. If I put $100 in the S&P 500 and it returns 10% over 7 years, I'm really comfortable off $200 at the end of 7 years.
Yeah.
But the number of private equity funds I've seen where their what they call the MOIC, the multiple on invested capital, is after 5 or 6 or 7 years 1.6, but they claim to have an IRR of 20%, and I just kind of can't figure out how that math works. Now, there is a way it does work, but it's just the ability to present correct data that's mathematically correct, yet doesn't really get you where you think you want to go, where, you know, you'd think if you had something for many years and it was a 20-plus percent IRR, you'd double plus your money and you find out you're only 1.5 or 1.6. And there is a way they got there. It has to do with drawdowns and borrowing money and all sorts of things. And so creates a whole other dynamic where at the end of the day, we're interested in taking existing capital and compounding it to larger amounts in order to fund our liabilities. So just, you know, it's not, it's just a is comment. It's not a bad or good comment. Yeah.
Yep.
So our most of our clients go into private equity with the objective of more or less getting at least, if not 1.8, 1.92 or something like that, you know, two times, so meaning you double your money over whatever time period it takes.
After fees and everything.
Yes. And so there was a comment earlier, and I think one from you, Nick, as well, about the dispersion. It's huge. You can see it even in your own portfolio between some of the funds you liquidated that performed very well, some that not so much. And so it can be 30, 40 percentage points between the better and the worse. You're never going to find that.
I think we actually
market.
Went even further than that.
when I see, to me, what I would define as success would be limiting those extreme outcomes. You surely can, and it would be nice to get the top percentile that makes a 7 or a 10 better. But for that, you took a lot of risk. It's for a likely very concentrated offering, et cetera. Everything has to work right. And if it doesn't, then you end up with a zero return and a write-off on issues or maybe some legacy tail assets, et cetera. So for us, if we can get into better than median, aiming for that top quartile, and do that consistently with very low loss ratios, and we compound and get into that doubling of your money becomes a lot more consistent. I've seen clients where out of 60 investments, 57 have gains, most are double digit, and maybe 3 have losses, and they can be explained very simplistic. Maybe they invested in emerging markets, the dollar moved up, performing fine in local currency, but when you translate, you have losses. Or maybe went into a specific sector like energy at the wrong time or some other, and that explains. And so that is understandable and acceptable. But when you have full write-offs, which I don't believe I have ever had one in our history across all clients, that is when something fell off and shouldn't have taken place. What other questions can we address?
Ryan, what do you see as the timing of when we would begin to?
I think we're starting some plan, thinking about planning and putting, you know, procedures in place. I think maybe as we're doing some pacing plans in Q3 next year and making initial investments, you know, probably at best Q4 of next year, maybe into 2024, and it's highly dependent on when money comes. You know, if we get a big surprise and money comes back quicker, we want to be prepared. So I want to be ahead of it and have kind of everything in place by mid-year 23, I would say.
And Leo, what you're reporting is that Makita has the skills and expertise and can kind of in a synergistic way potentially expand the scope of what you do for us to include private markets, and that's basically what you're sort of teeing up on a preliminary basis today.
Absolutely. We
yeah.
do have that capability. It's been proven for a multi-decade period, very strong back office resources. I would say out of the full-service consultants, of course I have a bias, but we have the track record to prove it. We are a specialist. I think private markets is a jewel within Makita, and we win many mandates competing with the specialists. Just El Paso is one of them. We have plenty of others that hire us just to do either private equity or a pan-private markets portfolio, and they don't even use us for the general piece. And then we have a number of clients that also use us, of course, for all assets within their portfolio. So from that perspective, I think we're unique in the sense that we're one of the few that has a long history managing or advising private markets portfolio, and in fact we have a track record with discretion that goes 15 to 20 years across asset classes. In fact, you know, here we summarize it, and these are all the, so if you look at the second row, that's private equity, goes back to 2000, and, you know, that depending on the stopping point, it's fluctuated about 1.8 to 2x.
278, right.
Page 278. Thank you. So overall, it's been pretty consistent, and what is not showing there is the risk that was taken to generate that return. And in public markets, you measure that by standard deviation. I think in private markets, my favorite way, I think it's one of the better ones, is to look at the loss ratio. So what percentage of your holdings have losses or were total write-off or loss? So, and that has been very, very low for us.
And then I always like to restate assumptions in the form of a question,
sure,
that if we were down the road to want to engage you in this, this is, you still would be the overall steward of the relationship. It wouldn't be like you might bring in specific subject matter expertise, but in terms of the overall, you would still be in the full accountability tunnel for everything, right?
Yeah, I have clients where personally I do the general consulting. I have some where I do both general and private markets, and I have some that I do just private markets. I do think that having expertise available would be desirable and appropriate. And for example, if it was something about policy and we want to discuss, or if it was a specific fund, we might just thing in whoever did the underwriting of that fund to address any questions. So from that perspective, I think I would view all of the 50 Nikita private markets professionals as available and part of the team, and I as the or Aaron as the primary point persons for you should have the flexibility to determine or to at least suggest to your who might be the better
person.
But
from an accountability standpoint,
yes.
It would be
you
and Aaron
marshaling
additional resources.
Yes.
But still, okay. And then for the group, to the extent we want to head down this path in general, sort of the three choices are do it alone, which I, you know, personally I think would not be an appropriate path for us, given for a bunch of reasons, to expand the relationship, you know, with Makita or Makita-like entity, or get a specialist firm just to do private markets. So those are all the things that, you know, we are going to be thinking about. I think overall we've had, you know, a terrific relationship with you guys, and what you've done, I think you've done a really fine job. So,
and we're going to talk with IAP next week about kind of the consultant RFP process and come back to the board in January with some more details on what we think it should look like.
So does everyone have a sense of kind of the timeline tunnel that we're on this, that this is still very early, this is in formation, you know, turning a notion into potentially a little medium to longer term actionable plan, and just trying to get ahead of it?
I think that's right, except the only caveat to that would be that if HUP sells this property and Lone Star gets a number of different assets sold, it may accelerate the time frame. We may want to, but we still need to be prepared. We can't start it without going through these steps. I'm being optimistic that we can get a couple hundred million dollars back.
Yeah, optimism would be.
A couple hundred million changes it, but I think as money's coming back, the priority is still kind of getting equity up to target and still getting safe reserves back to target before we're putting anything to work.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, Just so you know, when we were hired in 2018, we knew, you knew, that there would likely be no new investment in private markets for at least several years. So when the RFP was done in 2017 into 18, you did consider the capabilities of the consultants you interviewed, and you reviewed their RFPs for their private market expertise. Now, when it came time to contract negotiation, what we agreed and all did is, okay, there's no need to pay for these services because they're not going to be using, but there were some parameters set so that for some reason there was a need, there was the option to act on them. So if tomorrow you get all of the monies from, you know, the half fund and maybe Lone Star, which comprised 15% of the fund, you could act while you're still doing something else, because you have those resources available. So far, it's just almost on a sleeping pattern, but they're there if you wanted to. I think it's very good for you to revisit that, and I think you're going to be doing that next year as well.
How are we doing on time?
We're running long.
Do you want to have Leo go really quick here, or?
I can go quick.
Okay.
5 minutes. Okay, so this is the September 30th, so it's dated. That was a low point, really. So the markets have subsequently risen, so you've seen numbers that are more representative from Brian earlier today. But with the big write-up on half, the numbers on a relative basis versus peers for the total fund look pretty positive. So the total fund lost 5.2% for the trailing year, much better than policy and peers, again, substantially driven by that revaluation of your one holding. I would say the rest, the public markets portfolio, perform more or less in line with benchmarks. And again, it depends, again, how do you measure that and how do you include and what benchmark you use. For example, Bill, I know you question or mention, okay, when we look at our fixed income composite, we use the Barclays Multiverse. Is that fair or not? Well, the thesis there was, okay, we'll use the broadest benchmark out there. But it does cover a lot of global holdings. We do have a small piece into emerging markets. Is it appropriate or not? At some point in time, we can revisit all of the benchmarks. But I would say, I would summarize it, and you saw it from the presentation from Brian, public markets by and large are performing within expected ranges of variances. As a result of the denominator going down because of reductions in public and public stock and bonds, and an improvement in valuation on private equity, so the ratios here have worsened in terms of the liquid versus illiquid categories. But I think if you take a trajectory where it's still tracking well, it just hasn't been linear. Not much has changed since the last time, so I'm going to skip these pages and focus on So if you look at the 3 months or the year, you'll see it's all driven by private equity. This is an attribution, and the green means the manager alpha, if you will. And so from that perspective, you'll see that what explains your performance is the write-up in your private equity assets. To answer some prior comments about your manager's performance and how they do, if you take a look at any, so if we start at the bottom here on page 306 and you look at Boston Partners, which is the first one in here, well, you'll see the fund, you'll see the benchmark, and you'll see how the fund or the manager has ranked versus peers. So in this case, we look at all global value managers, and in this case, Boston Partners has performed across multiple time periods among the top third of them. But if you look at the dispersion of returns, compounding over 3-5 years, you know, it's a couple of percentage points. If you were to look at a top quartile fund in private equity, it's going to be a lot more than just 2 or 3 percentage points. And if you're looking at fixed income, like investment-grade bonds, it's going to be a lot less. It's going to be maybe 50 to 100 basis. And so that's how you view it. We'll provide a lot more context in early into next year, Nick, but, you know, at least you have some context by looking at your strategies. You'll see Manulife doing well in the quarter and in the long term, not so well just in the last year, but average.
How often do you do that schedule? Is that a monthly or quarterly?
This,
the one you just showed, yeah.
Well, this we do it monthly. We show it to you on a quarterly basis, but internally and for staff, this is a pretty easy output that we can generate pretty easily.
You may want to incorporate that because having the peer group is helpful, yeah. And it also is during the time period that they're actually managing money for us is helpful.
Yeah, I'll talk to Leo about kind of timing.
Yeah.
I don't know what time. Get it, you know, in time.
Maybe it's a 30-day lag instead of a 90-day lag.
yeah, there is. This is information that we get from investment. Usually, to have a robust enough universe, you have to wait until about the middle of the quarter. So for the first month, so for January, it's going to be meaningless, but once you get into February, you could have the December 31 data. So you could accelerate it a month, if you will.
Okay.
But for your meeting in January, we're not going to have anything robust enough to share with you as of December 31. You're going to have to wait.
That may work. Yeah, that works.
Yeah, we'll hear some of that. And like when we're doing a deeper dive, as we're going to Invesco, we'll have kind of looking at it in multiple different ways.
Yeah. And other than Invesco, there's really no manager that stands out as being substantially ahead or behind the expected performance.
Can you flesh to the scorecard thing that we talked to the IAP about too? One way to flag people if there's so many numbers in the report.
Yeah.
So this is part of kind of what we work with IAP on, is just, you know, a simple way for to flag anyone that's underperforming across 1, 3, and 5, and obviously it depends on what the benchmark is, and, you know, we don't formally have to do anything if they are, but it's a good kind of quick page.
Where are you on what page?
We're on 297.
297.
And this is where, you know, a lot of these managers we haven't had for 3 or 5 years, but, you know, if there's a lot of red there, then we need to look into deeper kind of how they're doing against their peers, how they're doing against, you know, Invesco, they're a growth manager. We compare them to a core benchmark for the purposes of this page, but, you know, it's just kind of the highest level tool, I would say.
Any more questions on the public markets report? If not, I'll spend a minute on the private. Okay. So this is the standard. So you've seen these presentations. Nick, the one you mentioned earlier is the ACT fund. So that's the one on the left that drives good returns. It's been a consistent performer for a multi-decade period. They were here a few months ago and they presented, and, you know, there's a plan in motion to try to continue that into the future. There's a very small allocation to Timber, actually, which is on its way out, as I understand it. Those are positions that are expected to be liquidated sooner than later. And then your two bigger holdings are the real estate and private equity, and private equity is the one that has seen that green bar jump up over the last quarter or so. So, exactly what you see there is a very strong performance for the ag. You know, you're compounding at over 3 times your money. That's very solid. But in everything else, you know, you don't go into private to sacrifice liquidity to just recoup your money. So ideally, you'll see more like somewhere between 1.3, 1.4 on the lower risk, lower return categories like maybe infrastructure, and get into about a 2x on average as the target for the risk-seeking private equity portfolio. Brian covered most of these. Most, you know, you don't have a lot of unfunded commitments since the last ones you made are in 2016. IVP is doing quite well. I'm on page 326. It's been consistent with venture capital. You happen to make a good commitment at a very opportune time, and you know, you may have some markdowns coming up in the next quarter or two. We'll see how those perform, but overall it's been very accretive. Unfortunately, it's been one of your smallest commitments at $5 million. So I think, I guess, in the interest of time, I'll pause because you've seen it before, and there hasn't been too much change. If you have any questions,
I guess for the newer trustees, maybe just show the completed fund page.
Yeah.
You know, this report only includes what's currently in the portfolio and the returns and the deposits. So anything that we sold, very, very small now, but moves to these back pages. You can see the history on some of the real estate and private equity that we exited prior.
Yeah. And here you have some funds that have performed well, you know, more than 2 times for money, and some that haven't, but my understanding is this was sold mostly as a package, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is more real estate, but yeah, the private equity.
Yeah.
You know, in 17, we sold 26 funds at one time.
Yeah.
So. All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
You can listen in. No, it's legislative. Might be interesting to hear. Thought if you want to.
Yeah, we have a 2 o'clock flight. But
okay.
With us today, Buddy Jones and Eddie Felice from Hilco, our legislative consultants. Hilco has been our consultants for more than 20 years. I don't remember exactly when you all started, but it's been a long time. Buddy and Bill Miller and maybe somebody else started Hilco. I don't know how many years ago, but
45.
Okay. And Buddy was, before he did that, among other things, he was chief of staff to a Speaker of the House, who I don't recall whose name that was, but whoever that was. But anyway, Hilco is one of the top, if not the top, legislative firms on the Hill, voted that way every year, and I think people understand and respect that. They were incredibly helpful for us in 2017 when we had the massive overhaul. Last session, they helped us with our TMRS bill as well as the bill on drop. So, I mean, they're very familiar with our plan, as well as pensions in general. And so they're here to give you an overview of the legislative session as well as what's going on with pensions down there. And I just want to express our appreciation for y'all to come up because, as you can imagine, this is their incredibly busy season as the lead up to the session next month, that things are blowing and going and probably have been for a couple months. So thank you very much for taking the time to come up here and talk to the board. And with that, I'll hand it over to you two.
Well, thank you, Josh. I'm Buddy Jones, and this is my colleague, Eddie Solis. And Josh is right. There's a cutoff time for campaign contributions for legislators who have won the election or are getting ready to serve in the legislature, and that cutoff time is Saturday. So as you can imagine, the last couple of weeks, we've had 20 and 30 fundraising events every day to attend. And so, this is a great respite from us having to go to some of those, so we're glad you had us, Kelly, down here. So first of all, I grew up in Dallas, grew up out in East Dallas. My daddy was pastor of Shiloh Terrace Baptist Church, Oaks and La Prada. And he said, Buddy, wherever you go, you need to make sure you give your word of personal testimony. So I'm here, and I'm going to give you my word of personal testimony. Don't die. It's not bad. We are so thankful at Hilco for having the opportunity and the great joy to represent this group of men and women and this pension fund. It has been one of the great parts of our business, and we thank you for your faith and your confidence, and we pledge to you to continue to work to make whatever we do in Austin a success for each of you and for the folks you serve. So thank you for that. And it's really been great to work with the staff here for over 20 years, Josh. I believe you're right. Kelly and others who preceded you, it's just been a great honor, so thank you. The 88th session, and we're going to cut our presentation down a little bit to let y'all catch up. The legislature, it kicks off the second Tuesday in January. A quick overview. First of all, redistricting is a weird time. It happens every 10 years. And every one of those 181 members of the legislature had to run this last year. We have 27 new House members. We had 6 new senators. And honestly, Eddie, I cannot remember in my 40 years having served in the legislature back in then any too many more classes with over 27 and 6 at one time. So there are a lot of new members, which gives us both a challenge to educate them on pension issues and an opportunity to start with a clean slate on pension issues. So we look forward to doing that with you and the staff's help. The House will currently, under the new redistricting plan, have 86 Republicans, 64 Democrats. That's a 2-Republican gain from last session, 86 and 64. The Senate will have 19 Republicans and 12 Democrats, which is a net 1 gain for the Republican Party in the Texas Senate. The state constitution prohibits the legislature from enacting laws in the first 60 days of a regular session, unless there is a motion to suspend the constitutional rule in the House or the Senate and it gets a 2/3 vote. I don't know how you get a 2/3 vote to even adjourn in the Texas House, but in the Texas Senate, they do suspend those rules. So the first 60 days, you'll hear probably from the Senate having started their business. And it will probably be on issues that don't relate as much to the businesses you all are interested in as they do to social issues. The Senate really seems to be honed in on social issues like who can swim and run track and play baseball in a girls' sport, and what kind of programs we will have for transgender operations, and what the state will do to woke corporations. And so I kind of expect social issues to crop up from the Senate. The House, on the other hand, never or rarely ever suspends constitutional rules, and I think they will hold firm that nothing will pass in the first 60 days so that some of those issues can be looked at in greater detail the first couple of months of the session. The lieutenant governor is strongly in control of the Texas Senate. Dan Patrick, during the redistricting session, redrew these 6 seats, and he helped recruit and support those who won most of these seats, and he is a strong leader, and I expect him to have a great influence on what happens in the Texas Senate. He will take border security as a big issue. He will take the grid. They just had their Republican caucus this last Sunday and Monday, and I am told that of the 19 Republicans, 17 of them put as their number one priority to make sure the electric grid is addressed in the right way. Now, that's a good issue. That's something we all need looked at. Some other issues that cropped up is how we're going to fund public education, border security funding, and property tax reform, which would probably also include appraisal tax reform. In the House, most all of their issues are bread and butter, kitchen table type issues. Issues like how are we going to fund infrastructure? How are we going to repair the infrastructure that's needed right now? Public safety. It ought to catch everybody's interest, public safety. They're going to deal with the health care. How do we deal with health care? Especially we've read all these stories about our officers having to deal more and more and more with mental issues, and our policemen and firemen and EMS have to deal with mental health issues. I think that's going to be a priority in the Texas House, Eddie. And the Speaker of the Texas House is a guy named Dave Phelan. Dog, I think he is a very strong leader. I think he shored up during redistricting his leadership of that body. He has some special challenges. The Republican Party seems to be kind of divided, with folks who kind of want to keep the ball in the fairway and folks who want it played out of the right rough a little bit. And I think the first vote he's going to have is a vote to keep the House from having Democratic chairman. Currently, about a third of the House committees are Democrats. And back when I was in the House, back in the early 80s, there weren't 18 Republicans in the House, but they had a pro rata number of chairmanships. And that's what's made the Texas House work as well as it has. And so I think we ought to watch that vote very carefully. If they don't do away with a bipartisan approach to things, we might come back and say we've got some problems on our hands. So let's cross our fingers. Anyway, there is a great deal of legislative fatigue. If y'all remember, we had three special sessions at the legislature this time dealing with stalemate on voter issues, who could vote, whether you had to show your driver's license, and whether that was an infringement on the rights of people to vote. And there was a walkout. The Democrats did do a walkout, and it shut the legislature down for much of that time. There are some lingering bad feelings. The Republicans that stayed are kind of not happy about the Democrats leaving. The Democrats that left weren't happy at being made to leave, they say, because of what the Republicans were doing on voter issues. So we'll have to watch and see how that walkout over voting issues will affect other legislative priorities. One thing I want you all to know, and we probably ought to pay particular attention, Kelly and Josh, to ESG issues. I'm sure you all have already talked about some of those, and will continue to do so. Y'all, that's going to be permeating everything that happens in the legislature.
Just on that, right, we don't have BlackRock doesn't manage any of our money. So we don't have that issue.
Well, thank goodness for that. And it hasn't morphed into local, small local pension systems yet.
Yet,
there you go. It usually morphs, and if anything happens in Florida, it'll happen in Texas, for obvious reasons. And it is happening in Florida. You saw what they did to Disney. And so BlackRock and others are on the carpet, and they're going to continue to be on the carpet, and they've been blacklisted by state government in some cases. So I want us to be careful that it does not morph into our system, but it could, and we might need some help in distinguishing ourselves at some point. Hopefully not. Okay, I had some more to talk about, but y'all are behind, and I'm going to stop right now. We will have an opportunity if you have some questions. But Eddie wants to talk about the issues that are particularly connected to pension. That's okay. Eddie?
Thank you, buddy, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, for having us here, and trustees. It has been a privilege to represent and work with you all these years. Things change, and I started in the pension world in 2006 working for the municipal retirement system, and that system itself had very transformational issues that it went through that I was fortunate to be there for, to learn in a quick amount of time. With that being said, it does not escape us the value of the work that you all do for the membership and their survivors. So anything that I say this morning has nothing to do with the validity or the value of an idea that might be out there. There are many issues that come up. We're blessed and fortunate and privileged to work with other retirement systems, and each one of them have a constituency that would like to see things differently for for the benefit on the benefit side, and that's understandable. But when it comes down to it, it's a matter of how or what condition any recommendation or suggestion will fall on with regard to any pension system. In this case, of course, Dallas Police and Fire. The legislature, in just my amount of time, has become very knowledgeable or sophisticated, as I like to consider it, on pension issues. And it's primarily on their side because of ERS and TRS, the Employees Retirement System and the Teachers Retirement System. They've been working on shoring those up for time and memoriam. And they not only have a pension system, as you all know, but they also have a health care system, insurance. And so those are very, very capital-intensive enterprises. One thing that Buddy, I'm sure, would have gotten to that is a unique condition of the legislature this time around is how much money they're going to have in their coffers. $27 billion surplus, $13.6 billion rainy day fund. There's money to solve issues. Having worked at the comptroller's office prior to TMRS, for 16 years, revenue estimating was a big part of our life and certainly in the legislative world. And the question has always been, is it easier to write a budget with money or without? And I don't think that answer that question can be answered. But this time around, they're going to have a lot of money. What does that mean to us locally? Well, I think it's a matter of what are they going to do? Buddy mentioned property taxes. How does that impact local revenue relative to what the municipality can do for the retirement system. In 2017, we had an amazing effort to right the ship, and it passed. We all worked very hard together, not only Kelly and Josh and the staff, but the stakeholders for this pension system. But even as that passed, we knew there were going to be challenges moving forward. It was going to take time, and I think the patience and focus is continued to be an advantage to you all and any system that is in that zone, if you will. And so as you all move forward, I think it's important to identify all those components. The fact that the legislature now, you know, back in 06, I'd walk into somebody's office and they wouldn't ask me, you know, what the amortization rate was. They wouldn't ask what the rate of return was. They wouldn't ask if there was a COLA or a drop. Now you go over there, they know those questions. Now, how deeply they know the components or the mechanics of that is different, but they know to ask. And relative to 2017 and the fact that ERS and TRS constituencies are persistent in their asks or their involvement with the legislature, it's always been, nobody wants it to change. They don't have any fiscal responsibility to local systems.
Let me make one point for the trustees that some of them know, but I'm not sure they all do. In 2017, there was a huge effort on Dallas, but there was probably an even bigger effort on all three of the City of Houston plans, mm-hmm. that involved a total overhaul of all three of those plans. And so it wasn't just a Dallas issue, it was a Houston issue. And so the legislators became acutely aware of pension issues around the whole state. So it was, I mean, they are very, very aware of much more how pensions work, funding issues, underfunded issues. And so it wasn't just the Dallas issue that was really made them sort of become conscious of the whole thing.
Thank you, Josh. That's a very good point.
And at the last session, they did some steps to address the ERS pension issues as well. So that's made them even more familiar.
Yes, sir. And of course, the financial backing that the teachers' retirement system has also, yes, sir, without a doubt. And, you know, to marry those two comments, those issues have been going on forever. I mean, the state, excuse me, this is not inside baseball. The state has been woefully under-contributing to those systems for a long time. But they have a constitutional floor. They have a statutory requirement of no benefits being increased if they're not actuarially sound. So they've got some differing environment than the local plans. The local plans certainly have very mindful and disciplined bodies that take and are stewards and are fiduciaries of local funds and those systems. So thank you for that, Josh. That is a very good point. And it puts us where we are today. They're curious of that. Your delegation, the Houston delegation, you know, the cities that were involved in the TMRS reform, if you will, their delegations became very, very understanding, and they realized what questions they could ask. And so that's where they are. With regard to that, I think it's also important to know that there's been an evolution of the Pension Review Board. And the PRB that has oversight, not regulatory authority, but oversight over all pensions, has become more, in my opinion, resourceful and more credible. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but there's just a lot of focus, and the resource and the trustee or the appointees that are now on the Pension Review Board just have a different focus, a different approach to local pensions and state pensions. And I know that Kelly and Josh, as well as myself and my colleagues, have a good working relationship with the folks at the Pension Review Board because they do provide valuable resources. And I know that Kelly and Josh provide good resource to them because they know what they don't know, and when there's questions that they have, it's a very, very positive reciprocal relationship. To kind of start winding this down, I think it's valuable to know that as you all probably do, the House has a committee now that covers pensions and investments. That committee sometimes toggles back and forth. Sometimes it's just pensions. Sometimes it's pensions and investments. We're not sure. We don't know now what that's going to be coming forward. But Chairman Anchia has run that committee well. We've worked well with him for many, many years on many issues, and always approachable, always accessible, and very, very helpful. On the Senate side, there is a likely and possible and likely shift from pension issues going from state affairs, where it has been the jurisdiction for many, many sessions, to Senate finance. And that being the result of Chair Huffman, who presided over state affairs over 2017 and over the last several sessions over pensions, is now chair of finance. So we've heard from her staff that the chair has asked the lieutenant governor to have that issue sent to Senate Finance. And certainly on ERS and TRS, it makes a lot of sense. That's where the money is. But so we'll be seeing that. We've got a wonderful working relationship with Chair Huffman and her staff and that committee. So we look forward to being able to work through any issues that may come up.
Eddie, wasn't Senator Huffman involved? I'm trying to remember on the Houston issues,
yes,
that Josh was talking about it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And presided over state affairs when those big bills came through. So, Buddy, I'll just kind of go full circle. Buddy mentioned the new members that are in the House, the new members that are in the Senate. I think three of them are what they joke around at the legislature. Three new senators are what they call House broke, meaning they came in through the House of Representatives, which is valuable, because it does bring someone in with already a base of knowledge and understanding of the legislative process and the need to be able to discuss issues and kind of go back and forth on that. But we wanted to lay out as much as we could in a short amount of time and leave it to any questions, Kelly and Josh, Mr. Chairman, if there are any.
What did you say was the House person overseeing pensions?
Anchia. Rafael Anchia.
What?
Rafael and Chia?
Dallas.
Out of this
Dallas.
Okay.
Actually, he's in this area right here.
Yeah.
Oh. That's right. You're right.
But as you know, during, you know, at the outset of every session, the first major task is to pick a speaker. We're very confident it's going to be Speaker Phelan once again. And then, of course, later on in the session, January, late, maybe early February, committees are assigned. When you see such a new crop of members, you've got to understand that if there's new ones, there are old ones that left. So there's a lot of transition committee-wise. Don't know what's going to happen on pensions and investments, but to see transition in a lot of these committees is to be expected solely because of that transition. So.
I just have one question and one comment after your answer. So you guys have been with us a while. You've been through the good, the bad, and the ugly. So
what do you see looking at us now that you think would need tweaked going into the next legislative session, which would be 2025, when we're going to get looked at?
Well, if I may, I think it's just a matter of what happened in 2017, what passed in 2017 needs to take good root.
Needs to take what?
Take good root. It
okay.
really has to get firm. As I mentioned, nothing that I say is to discount or in any way minimize the suggestions that will come forward to you by your membership. But the system needs to get on solid ground. And it's been difficult for various reasons. We're glad that the bill passed in 2017. I think it was existential. I think it was a very important necessity to go forward. But at this point, as we talk, as I go about my daily discussions with staff and members, their questions are the ones that remember, how's it going? What are they doing? You know, and it's here, it's Houston, it's others that we work with. And so there's enough of that knowledge and recollection to say, well, what, you know, how are things? And, of course, the Pension Review Board is somebody that members now really access quite a bit. Used to not be that way. And there's a good dialogue between Kelly and Josh and the PRB. The PRB's got open lines back and forth. But to your question, I just think that I don't think anything needs to be tweaked at this point. I think in the next couple of years, I think 3158 had a measure that would allow for the Pension Review Board to take a look. And I think that can kind of be the bogey to say maybe we should consider trying to just keep growing this foundation that was passed in 2017 and not have anything that might rock the boat much financially. Returns are what they are. I heard Kelly's presentation a couple of weeks ago to the advisory committee. You know, you can't do it on cuts. You can't do it solely on contribution. You know, it's the three-legged, you know, revenue stream. Contributions, investments, and, of course, sponsoring entity contribution as well. So I think it needs to stabilize. It needs to keep going forward. I think it's a better position. This system's in a better position than it would have been had we not passed that bill in 2017. But we knew there were going to be challenges ahead and hard work and tough decisions. And this is kind of that period that I think everybody was realizing was going to happen.
That being said,
excuse me.
We're on the field. You are our coach. You'll tell us what we need to be doing, and we intend to do it. And I bet some of it is to make sure bad pieces of legislation do not come to fruition. But there may be something that you'll want us to advocate for. And
yeah, I mean, to that end, the line of duty death, is that something you're going to be helping us advocate for in this session?
If directed, yes, sir. We're,
yeah.
I mean, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have a draft that was submitted, as you all probably know. It goes through a legislative crafting or a template review from the Legislative Council. But we are going to do what, as Buddy said, we're going to do what you direct us to do. But of course, if that is the mission, that is what we are going to do. Yes, sir.
Can you briefly talk about how the legislature views sort of plan change, you know, for a plan like ours that's underfunded, how they would view those changes that increase benefits?
I will, Josh, and I meant to be a little more clear about that, but the reality is as we talk to the members and their staff, the question is it good timing? Are they, or anybody, you know, we've got others that we're working on, and I think the issue to those that remember this legislation, like Chair Huffman, is to identify anything that's going to come towards this system and whether or not it is coming at a good time. And so that level of knowledge, that level of understanding exists, and the question will be there. And, of course, the Pension Review Board has to – any legislation affecting pension would have to be scored or analyzed by the Pension Review Board. But yes, Josh, thank you. It is a keen awareness of the legislature to identify a system that they just worked with to realize whether or not more can be done to that. And so back to your question, what needs to be tweaked and to Buddy's comment, defense is critical, always is, and we're always on the field for that. We will get direction, but the question that has come up and will come up is that, whatever that is, a good time to do to any system, to introduce to a system? And so that's kind of an actuarial and a very sophisticated look at that, but it is on you all to make that decision. But I do think that there is plenty of curiosity out in the membership, the legislature, the committees that remember this and the members that do, as to whether that system is ready for anything further.
Yeah, I think the will of the board is that we would like for you to advocate for this, and that you know, I recognize that I don't really appreciate the whole political process, and that's why, you know, we have you guys involved. In the bigger picture, the analogy I would say is that, you know, since 2017, we have created a very solid functioning ship that is not leaking anything and is not has made a lot of forward progress. That being said, we don't have enough fuel in the tank to take us to the full voyage, you know, decades later to fund all of our liabilities, or we would need, you know, much higher investment returns over a 67, I think we're 68 years. Yeah. You know, which is beyond a long time. So, you know, we recognize the need for some external funding, you know, down the road, pursuant to the political process and so on with all the different stakeholders. But, you know, this issue is one that we feel strongly about, and, you know, if that rocks the boat a little bit or, you know, deemed not a great time, I think we're saying push through that.
Can you, Josh, just reiterate what that, exactly what it is we're asking for people that pass in the line of duty, that they get the same benefit that somebody else?
No. So basically what the board had wanted to put forward in legislation, and that's what we've drafted, is a bill, is a change to the plan that allows if someone dies in the line of duty, that their surviving spouse or surviving beneficiary children would receive a 100% benefit
right
at that point in time. So that's what we've drafted and is with legislative council now, and, you know, we'll see what happens. But as you recall, the conversation was other things, but you all, I think, correctly, as Eddie and Buddy are saying, determined we just wanted to be as narrow as, you know, provide the benefit, but be as narrow as possible given our funding level. Yeah.
Is the city supportive of that, or have we talked to the city at all?
I have talked to the city about that a couple of times, and they haven't come out and said they're supportive, but they haven't said they're not supportive either. And some of that has to do with some turnover in their actuarial group. So I would think the city would support it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if they didn't.
And just a comment on some of the things that I'd like to see tweaked. This is coming from me. And it's purely cosmetic. I mean, you guys tell us if it's possible or not. I mean, to me, I think the three-year term limit is a little bit short. I'd like to see it go back to four as far as, you know, our trustees go. Picking the association reps, you know, they pick three and we vote three. I mean, to me, that's like a waste of time. I have full confidence in the association's vetting process and putting forth the clients for being on the board, and I see that kind of a waste of time just to vote for three. I think the no votes that these guys get is just simply because they don't know what they're retirees don't know what they're doing. Am I voting for one candidate or all three? I don't understand why. Why would I have to vote for all three since there's only three there? And then the verbiage of active and retired member, you know, if the actives and the retirees, to me, they're all members.
they should vote for the police rep as well as the fire rep, and if they want to have a process involved as far as voting. And then lastly, I'd like to see the clawback sword that's hanging over the retiree's head go away. I mean, I understand that was political a bit, but I think the process that we've shown what the board can do, I mean, I really don't think it's necessary to have that there. I'd like to see that go away.
Ken, my recommendation, and of course if the board wants to do something different, obviously I'm happy to do that, was that we know we're going to have probably some significant changes in 2025 legislative session, and we would do some of the things you're mentioning, because I agree with some of the items you mentioned, a couple of them I hadn't thought about, but there are some other cleanup items that I would like to do. We just were going to wait until 2025.
And I just mentioned them now to get them on record, because I don't know if I'll be here in 2025, you know, to be honest with you. And then lastly, the thing I do like, especially that I never want to see change, is how the IAC is put together and functions. I mean, that I'll put that, and I've said it 100 times, I'll put that up against any pension system in the country as to how great that process works. And then my last suggestion would be to the chairman, before 2025 comes along, we have a like an ad hoc legislative committee of either board members or IAC members to work with HILCO on these changes, so that, you know, when we do go to Austin and we go in front of legislators, that we're a group. This is the committee that you're talking to. You know, before, yeah, we did a good job with all the associations, and we did a good job with staff and members. I mean, to me, one large, strong, ad hoc committee to get our point across what we need would probably be helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'll be mega ad hocing then,
okay.
With some external funding thing as well as part of that. But for, you know, this session, we have this important yet narrowly defined request that we'd like for you guys to push through. Okay,
that's
anything
all
else?
Got, and thank you guys for all the hard work you did back in 2017 and continue to do for us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate the presentation.
Thank you. Thanks for coming up.
We're going to head back to Austin. Is that okay?
Thank you.
We've got to give out some more money. This is awful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly, Executive Director's Report.
Your association newsletters are attached. We received one open records request this morning. Actually, it's the only one since the last meeting. The board meeting schedule is on page 365. We've just slotted it at the second Thursday, our normal meeting time. And these are the dates for you. In the past, sometimes we've had problems with conflicts with spring break. So if you're anticipating anything, you know you're going to be out of town, shoot Melissa a message, and it looks like you know already, hey, we can move some things around. But this is the planned schedule for next year.
Okay, great. Go to the funding policy benchmark.
That, if we go to page 343, John. You might recall at the last board meeting when we were talking about the actuarial valuation, we mentioned that we have this funding policy that we were required to adopt by the PRB, and the city participated in drafting this funding policy. The policy has a benchmark in it that says that anytime we have two actuarial valuations where the actuarially determined contribution is more than 2% above the actual city contribution, the board needs to consider whether you want to notify the city that we would like to have more contributions. So that's what this item is. We'd like to discuss this this in closed session with the board under legal, just to give you more information about that. And then we have the normal legal item, and then closed session on medical, and then personnel items. So the next one, two, three, four items are closed session.
Okay, so we can go to closed session now?
Yeah.
Public comment.
I'm sorry?
Your public comment.
Okay. Make your public comment. Well, we asked earlier, but go ahead. We'll let you do it now.
Step into the restroom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is in regards to the beer heard a lot of finance stuff today. Our actual rate of return is 6.5%. If I got it right, I believe Brenda said the return for 2021 was 5.8%.
5%.
5.8.
5%. The investment was 5%.
So we didn't meet 6.5. So I was just my question. Hopefully, Makita being here, in terms of the capital market assumptions, how they're viewed. The forecasting model maybe that Makita does, when do we anticipate hitting 6.5% or above?
The 6.5 is really meant to be a long-term average. So, you know, that's the number we expect to hit. I mean, it's not when you say when, over the medium and long term, we expect to hit 6.5% in all of our you know, the way we allocate capital and there's expected returns, all that sort of consolidates into an expected set of returns that has, you know, upside and downside to it. But, you know, we've lowered it over time. I think just since 2017, what was it around then? I also think in our actuarial calculation, they didn't quite use the 6.5 in some of the early years, so it actually was...
There was a ramp-up.
Yeah, it's been a ramp-up, and I don't recall what that was for...
I think it was 5.75, or was it 5.25, Ryan, that the ramp-up?
I think it's a three-year ramp, 5.75, 6.5.
Yeah. So,
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I didn't ask. We used to have one of our managers, GMO, Jeremy Grant, who used to put out forecast models, you know, with that 5-7 year forecasting. NEPC used to do those forecasting models regarding capital market assumptions over a 3-7 year period. I don't know if Makita does or not, but I guess I'm just curious, you know, in the climate we're in, you know, when we might be getting those kind of returns.
So, Rick, I know this isn't supposed to be back and forth, so I'm just going to say this, and then maybe we can meet with you separately. Makita does have those models. They've run the target asset allocation for DPFP through their model, and with that, when we have our assets at target, we feel confident that we can meet the 6.5%. The problem that we have is it's taking us longer just to get to that target because of some of these private assets. So we talked a lot today about HUF. When HUF sells, you know, that'll go a long way towards getting closer to the target. That's the delay in getting to, you know, to the full the full return at this time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Great, thanks.
The other thing is interest rates have gone up quite a bit in the last year. So having interest rates at 5 instead of 2 is going to help us to get there on an ongoing basis as we free up those assets.
All right, so we're going to go into closed session.